government regains the trust of its citizens is by telling the truth. There is no other way, no shortcut.
I call upon our government to open up like the Belgians have, the French have, the Brazilians have, the Argentines, the Mexicans have all released their files. It's about time now that we do the same thing and become a part of this planetary community.
It is way past time for all of us to know what our own government knows, instead of being kept in the dark by a policy of denial.
The last time the Congress held a hearing addressing the extraterrestrial issue was 1968, 44 years of sightings ago. In those 4.5 decades, hundreds of thousands of new sightings have taken place. Government agency witnesses have come forward. Media coverage has expanded. Hundreds of documentaries have been produced. Thousands of books have been written. And yet the United States Congress has remained silent. So for a period of 5 days, at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., 2 blocks from the White House, 12 blocks from the Congress of the United States, we're going to conduct a citizen hearing on disclosure of an extraterrestrial presence engaging the human race. 40 to 50 witnesses of high rank and station, from military, from agencies, possibly from intelligence services, along with the top researchers in the world, will give 30 hours of testimony to 5 former members of the United States Congress.
So maybe the citizens hearing has a chance to try to leverage open some of the truth about the fact that we're not alone in this universe, that we might actually begin to look at what we really are, what the true history of this planet is, and that might be what gets us into a future without self-destruction.
The model of the citizen hearing is if Congress won't do its job, the people will.
Greetings, everybody. Welcome to Galactic Roundtable, Countdown to Disclosure. I'm so happy to be back here with you again today. I'm starting to feel kind of normal again because I came back from Washington, D.C. extremely fatigued. And I would try to work, and the next thing I knew, my eyes would be closing. I slept on Saturday, Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday, and I couldn't keep myself awake. I had been to L.A. to see the premiere of the Sirius movie by Dr. Stephen Greer. And I had 1 day back at home, and I left for 10 days to Washington, D.C. And I'm finally starting to feel normal again this morning. So that's great. I have an announcement to make. I'm very excited and pleased. We will have a live interview with Stephen Bassett May 10th on Friday, May 10th. So please tune in for that. I'll be calling others, Senator Mike Gravel, Danny Sheehan, the attorney for the Iran-Contra trial and the Pentagon Papers, Grant Cameron, who is the cousin of the UK Prime Minister, David Cameron. He's dedicated his life to being a UFO researcher. Linda Moulton Howe, and several others all agreed face-to-face in Washington, D.C. that they would love to come on for live interviews on the radio. So I asked Danny Sheehan if he would talk about the spiritual part of disclosure, because he made a statement at the citizens' hearing saying that when disclosure happens, spirituality will be an important factor as our society changes. And that's what I'm going to ask him to speak about. Grant Cameron has spent his life working on what the presidents know about disclosure. And the senator, I don't have his brochure here, but he is headed up a movement to help citizens get their government to be responsive. And that's what he'll be speaking about. And, of course, I'll have him comment on his participation in the citizens' hearing. He's a very dynamic person. It will be very exciting. I have other witnesses that have said they'll come on. So we're moving into a new phase where we're going to do more interviews. I was just commenting to someone. I was saying that in the early day, Monday or maybe Tuesday of the citizens' hearing, some of the congressional members were saying it would be wonderful if this led you to having a real congressional hearing on this topic. And I was sitting in my chair and I was thinking, no, you don't understand. We raised $500,000 so that we could create this congressional hearing. You know, at this congressional hearing, we have control over what information comes out and, you know, who is rebutting the information. We won't be given the runaround. We won't be told our time is up, and we won't have Paige Shills on the side of the congression, on the congressional panel saying, you know, debunking every other word that is said. No. What we did the citizens' hearing to create a real congressional hearing. It was all of the. It was all of the stuff that's in a real hearing. So now these medical doctors who have PhDs, these physicists who have PhDs and above, these, you know, witnesses from 10 different countries, and these historians like Linda Moulton Howe and Richard Dolan, the cream of the crop, plus all the Roswell people who are the experts and the Bentwaters people who are experts and their witnesses, were there, including Jesse Marcel Jr., including John Burroughs, and including James Peniston. It was exemplary. It could not have been better. And this will definitely change everything. The wheels are in motion, and there's nothing that's going to stop disclosure now. Today, yesterday, we heard some pretty thrilling video about J-Rod, who had been held captive. I think the year is 1958, if I have that right, when he came to Earth and was taken prisoner, if you want to, into the S4 section of Area 51 in a special cold hydrogen chamber under the ground. And he has been ill for many, many years. He had been ill for many, many years. And so I understand that in the early years when he came here, in the early years, he could leave the cold hydrogen chamber for portions of the day and have a more normal life, interacting with people in Earth atmosphere, but still under the ground, still in Area 51, never leaving those hallways, but being able to interact a little bit. And then after some years, then he became more ill and could never leave the cold hydrogen sphere they had him in, and was leading the life of a prisoner. In 2003, the Army removed him from there, or I should say the military removed him from there, and took him to Abydos, Egypt. And they did that because they believed that a stargate was going to open. And they had him in a little cart. And I want to describe it something like the Popemobile. Of course, it was nothing like that, but it was a little, I want to say it was a contained environment around a little cart, if you understand what I'm saying. And the person who was driving the cart was with him. And he asked that person to help him leave. And they, reluctantly, this person agreed, and they took the cart full speed ahead, and they drove it right into a solid wall, but it was the Stargate, and the Stargate was open, and he went home. Far-fetched tale, maybe, but it's true. It happened. The military was very disappointed. They had lost their captive, but the reason I'm sharing that he went home is to say that we don't know how many more there are. There could be a dozen more captive. And from what we understand, these ones have lifetimes of 800 or 900 years. They came from in the future. And so 50 years on Earth or 60 years, we're not expecting them to pass away anytime soon. But we're holding them here because we can't tell our citizens the truth. That doesn't really seem right. It would be like being sent to Gitmo for 60 years. What I want to share with you today is, well, let's see, let's go back to yesterday. Yesterday we were talking about how at the, we were talking about how Eisenhower, or maybe 2 days ago, we were talking about how Eisenhower had ordered the CIA to get a report from Area 51, or he was going to invade Area 51 and find out what in the world was going on out there because he had been blocked out of the information. So during that meeting, when the CIA agents went out there, they saw UFOs with swastikas on them. If you look at Admiral Byrd's secret diary, and probably no one living can say if that diary is authentic or not, it seems to resonate with me when I read it. I'm not a historian, so maybe I'm speculating, but I've heard two other witnesses say they've seen UFOs, seen eyewitness UFOs with swastika on them at Area 51. So Admiral Byrd's diary matches that information. And that was brought forward back in the 60s. So maybe it's true, maybe it's not true, but it totally matches two eyewitnesses. So I don't know. I'm leaving that for you to decide. I now have friends who are historians, and they their work is you can't touch their work, but those historians require 3 cooperations before they'll even mention anything. But that's not my role. My role is to inform and share. So Admiral Byrd's diary says he saw UFOs with swastikas on them in the inner earth when the Navy planes went into the inner earth. And that's, I want to share the Admiral Byrd information with you tomorrow. And today what I have in between those two is some testimony from the citizens' hearing from this CIA operative. This witness name is anonymous. It is the only testimony that was by videotape. And Richard Dolan and Linda Moulton Howe were both there to testify that they have both met him, been in his home, and heard his testimony and videotaped him before. Both of them 14 years apart. So they're both sitting there saying, we know this guy, Linda has been to his house, I've been to see him recently, and get this videotape for you, and he's for real. So it begins with Stephen Bassett saying why he allowed this testimony, and then you're going to hear some pretty stunning stuff. This is more information than has been out there before. It's fabulous. If you haven't heard it, hang on to your seat.
Excuse me. We need to start with the oath. Would you please swear in the witnesses?
Ms. Howe and gentlemen, if you would please stand and repeat after me. I do hereby affirm that I will tell the truth and nothing but the truth to this committee today. Thank you.
Yes, and this is this is the, as I understand it, the truth embargo panel. Is that a fair statement of this panel? Great. And I'd like to call upon Stephen Bassett to
opening remarks,
and a film, as I understand it.
Yes.
Thank you.
The reason I asked for the committee's time is that what comes next is a little more, nuanced and complicated, because it's not a person here. It's going to be a video. Now, this is a judgment call. Obviously, we prefer to have an individual here testifying under their own name. In this case, we're going to have a 15-minute video of someone whose name is not going to be used, though his countenance will be used. In a sense, this video represents the many, 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 many individuals out there who could not come before a committee like this, who want to talk, but it's difficult. The vast majority of individuals who have interacted with this issue while working for the government, going back to the 40s, took the information that they had to their grave and did not talk if they were told not to talk. That's fine, and that's perfectly okay. Some have, some haven't, some have been conflicted. This gentleman posed a decision, meaning, do we do this or not? Do we run this video? And ultimately, the decision was mine and mine alone to do this. No one else within the organization. This individual is in extremely poor health and probably will not be with us much longer. The reason that the individual does not want the name used is that the story is quite powerful. His intersection was quite powerful, and he's received numerous threats from his government not to talk. It has been a while since the last threats were issued, which included his family, but and I think this times have changed, but we understand that just because I feel that way doesn't mean that he feels that way, and he's still concerned. Fine. But he wanted this testimony to be presented. We agreed, and that's why you're going to hear it today. And probably the key thing that made the decision to go ahead with showing this video, and by the way, we want the lights to be dim definitely when this video shows, so that's not washed out. So will we be lowering the lights in the house for the video? Is that as it happens, he has been interviewed by two researchers, and they are here at the table today. Linda Moulton Howe, interacting with this gentleman almost 14 years ago. When he was thinking of coming forward, but then backed away due to threats to his family and himself. And then recently, Richard Dolan interviewed him. And so that gives us a very strong perspective and ability to, quote, address the video, what it means. But ultimately, I would like to say this, that what you see in this video is the intersection of the human aspect of the truth embargo and the policy of the truth embargo. There are consequences. People are affected, and that's just the way that it is. There's also fundamental important testimony here, and I should also add that this is 15 minutes of many hours of interview. There is a lot more information than this. However, we have no desire to, quote, press to get that out. We don't want this gentleman to be vetted. He wants to finish out his life in peace, well and good. So I leave it to the audience to judge the value of this video and obviously the veracity of it. Each person will come to their own conclusion. Thank you for your time.
Yes, well, as we get older and older, I'm 77 right now. You can't live forever, you know. So, if procedure I'm going to have to clean the blood doesn't work, then I've got probably a few more months to make it before my kidneys shut down, you know. So that's kind of why I'm kind of going along with the interview at this time.
You're seeing that what you went through is just too important for people not to know about.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can you just, can we start at the beginning with your military career and just walk through what exactly your experiences were?
Was in the drafted into the military and got into the U.S. Army. After that, I was sent to the Signal Training Center in eastern United States.
What year would this be?
58. I went through the Signal Training course. And at that time, I went through the radio teletype course and also the cryptography course, crypto. They had five instructors that were getting out of military service. So they pulled the top five students, and I was third in the class, so I got pulled as an instructor.
Now, were you at this time also working yet for CIA?
No.
Not yet?
No. After one day, my boss came to me, and he said, how would you like to, you know, make some extra money? And I said, oh, money is good. So he explained to me that I could, he could put it through, like, would have to get a top secret White House Q clearance for the job, you know. And I thought, boy, must be a pretty exclusive thing, you know. And I said, well, what is this? And he said that I'm director for the CIA for Eastern United States, you know. And I said, oh, I didn't know that. And he said, you weren't supposed to. After about 6 weeks, my security clearance came through, and I got my CIA card. It was an ID card, like a credit card, where I could just go up to the door and slice it, walk right in. And my name at that time, I used an artificial name too. Never used my real name. I started working with him on the project he was on, and that was Project Blue Book, which was kind of partially a fraud.
You're saying some of the Blue Book cases were,
yes,
were completely fictitious?
Yes. But the cases that we got came from, I think it was Fort Belvoir, Maryland.
Mm-hmm. Fort Belvoir?
Yeah. And it didn't come from the Pentagon, or it didn't come from CIA headquarters. But cases, or if it was
seized frequently.
I wasn't, but I always stayed statewide. But the people we had working with us from the CIA would do that. We would get like a new report probably a couple times a week. I was coming into the Army fresh off the farm, you know. So I really didn't fill me in on Project Blue Book and what they had found so far as Greys and aliens and the Roswell incident.
How did you feel when this first got dumped on you? When you first learned about this?
I was just kind of overwhelmed with all of this, you know. And I said to him, I don't know if I'm going to be able to be a judge of this type of thing. What's real, what's not, when I don't have much knowledge of it, you know. So
what did he say?
He said, well, we have to build the information as we go, and you'll see how this thing is working out.
And then the other thing is, of course, you really weren't able to tell family or close friends, obviously.
No, I couldn't tell anybody. In fact, I had to take a vow that I wouldn't tell anybody a lot of it for 40 years and more of it for 50 years, which is up in 2010.
You're doing all this crypto work, you're looking at images, photographs, video. It's 1958, maybe the fall of 58. What happened after this?
At that time, the Project Blue Book thing kind of went pot, you know. If you remember, back in those days, they kind of declared it as a nothing, you know.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And
they were telling the world all UFOs are misidentifications, hoaxes, psychological issues, whatever.
Yes.
Yeah.
So my boss came to me and he says, we've both got a new assignment. And he says, oh, I said, where are we going? Oh, he says, we're going to the Capitol. We're going to be part of the Eisenhower push. He's trying to find out something about, all about these aliens that MJ-12 was supposed to find out, but never sent back reports to him.
MJ-12, the UFO control group, were they calling it MJ-12
yes.
at that time?
Yes. They called us in, went into the Oval Office, and President Eisenhower was there, and Nixon, and they said, we called the people in from MJ-12 from Area 51 and S-4, but they told us that the government had no jurisdiction over what they were doing. So being a general, past general, you didn't tell them to go to hell without any real good reason, you know. Mm-hmm. So he said, I want you and your boss to fly out there. I want you to give them a personal message. He says, I want you to tell them, whoever is in charge, tell them that to get in, they have this week, coming week, to get into Washington and to report to me. And if they don't, I'm going to get the First Army from Colorado and we're going to go over, we're going to take the base over. I don't care what kind of classified material you got. We're going to rip this thing apart.
Eisenhower was going to invade
Area 51. Yeah, with the First Army.
So you go out with your superior.
Yes.
You fly out. You land. What happens? Can you describe this whole process? What you saw?
It took us the 13 or 15 miles south to S4 and like different garage door openings. And in these garage door openings, they had like different saucer crafts. The very first one had the Roswell craft. It was kind of crashed up, but apparently every alien that was in it died except for a couple.
So you see the Roswell craft, and what are some of the others that you see?
Well, the Roswell craft was really strange because it looked like real heavy aluminum foil. We could rock next to it, and you could rock it. The whole thing probably weighed 150, 300 pounds.
Could they tell what the source of power was of this craft?
Yeah, it was like a reverse gravitational thing of some kind. In fact, one later on, I got the mathematical code for reversing gravity in a 3x5 card. I guess there are different types of grays and so on.
How did you see that evidence?
Well, at the later on at S4. We viewed the autopsy film, and then the colonel said, what we've got in here is we're interviewing a gray alien.
All right, right there. How did you feel at that moment?
Well, I thought, boy, we had no idea we were going to see the real thing. All we saw was film.
You had to have a little bit of heart racing
yes.
at that moment.
My boss was able to go in and had a partial interview with him.
So what did this gray alien look like? Could you describe him a little bit?
This one looked a little bit oriental.
So I'm just wondering, if it looked almost human, what about this didn't look human?
No, it didn't look human as far as the skin tone and basically the shape of it and the size.
How was its head size compared with a normal human, for example?
Brain was kind of a little bit bigger. And some of the nose was very, very small. And the ears were just like holes. Mouth was very small.
Now, why were they bringing you out here at all, anyway, to see an alien? What was the point?
To go back and tell the president they actually had one.
So he did not know at this point?
No.
If there was an alien at S4?
No.
What did you do then at Area? Were you done, or did you have other things to do?
Yeah, so basically we were kind of done, went back to Area 51. Mm-hmm. They took us into the main building, and there we saw a U-2, which of course we didn't know existed. Mm-hmm. And a model of the SR-71.
Yeah, the Blackbird.
So, but like I mentioned earlier, was not a model of the current Blackbird.
An earlier version.
But an early version.
Did you go directly to Washington after this?
Yes.
Or did you go somewhere else? How did they get, did you fly regular airline?
We flew back to the commuter plane back to the airbase. Uh-huh. And then took President Eisenhower's Lockheed Electra back to Washington.
You and your supervisor,
yeah,
superior officer, and now you're meeting with the president?
Yes.
Can you describe this?
Well, we met with him in, the second story of the old OSS warehouse building. And Eisenhower and Nixon were there, and also Hoover was there. So he asked us what was going on, and we told him about the alien whole situation and the black projects and so on. And he was just totally shocked. He appeared for the first time to be worried.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like he was worried.
I would think that Eisenhower would, I mean, he certainly knew that flying saucers were real.
Yes.
He knew that there were aliens. So I guess I'm just wondering, what would he have been, you know, really surprised about?
Surprised about the black programs. Eisenhower said, gotta keep this thing completely secret. You know, can't talk about this.
The black programs were the UFOs that had swastikas on them that came from the Nazis and Adolf Hitler and had been there. It's not mentioned in this clip, and it's not made public to keep this guy safe until the end of his days. But in the hours of videotaping that they did, that part came out, and this is what him and his supervisor were sharing with Hoover and Nixon and Eisenhower. This visit that he made to these three was a turning point in keeping everything secret because the Nazis were involved, presumably.
Your actual name is, I mean, the name you grew up with, was a different name than what
yes,
you had in this.
I never used it in the CIA at all.
Now, what about today? You're going on the public record, and this is still sensitive information, even though earlier you talked about, you know, security oaths that maybe expire after a certain period of time.
50 years.
But you're still concerned.
Linda Moldenhall's phone call, her phone was tapped, and they got my phone number, and through the telephone company, they're able to find me, and so on.
when they found you, what happened?
I was going to a grocery store. Two guys in black suits came out of a black Lincoln town car and came over to see me. Mm-hmm. And they told me that I better not publish anything or talk to Linda about any more things. So at that time, I did, you know, I stopped.
That was enough to intimidate you?
Yes. Rather remain anonymous. Never show my face on anything.
Really, thank you for doing this.
Yes, this was, I guess, kind of a good idea because I feel much better having talked about it. I kind of feel like there's a load off my shoulders.
Really?
Because I had an awful lot of secrets that I had kept over the years.
I'd like to now hear from Linda Moulton Howe. And could the timekeeper give me an indication of the time limits on the remaining witnesses?
If we're going to have a one-hour lunch, we have an hour and 5 minutes remaining.
Okay, so...
if we don't want an hour lunch, we have 2 hours and 5 minutes remaining.
Calculating out the mouse. go ahead, you've got 10 minutes.
In the summer of 1994, I spent 3 days and three nights in that gentleman's home. No one on the planet knew where I was, not my family, not anyone. I recorded 11 90-minute audio tapes with him. I knew that I was in the presence of somebody who was telling the truth to the best of his ability, and that the military cover of levels of intelligence in this country has been used for a very long time. On the surface, he was a cryptologist working in the United States Army. But as he described in the film, he took on a role, highly classified, working for the CIA, and his boss was reporting to Langley from reports that were coming into Fort Belvoir. And he described to me in great detail the autopsy footage that he had seen of non-humans, describing the unusual brains and the unusual internal organs, and the fact that they were screening film disguised as being on a southeastern military base, and that the film that they were screening on a regular basis was coming from around the world. He had seen film from Italy in which non-humans were outside of a craft, and the film had been taken from a nearby peak in a mountain. He talked about Area 51 from his firsthand experience of being there on the other side of what would be a one-way mirror while his boss from Langley was inside with a non-human, and that he himself had seen some of the craft, like a museum that's inside of Papoose Mountain. After those 3 days and three nights where no one knew where I was, I left to do something that would be normal in the normal 9-to-5 world. And when I returned to my home then in Philadelphia, I remember going to the phone and voicemail. And the last thing that we had agreed upon was that I would return in approximately 4 weeks with a video crew in which I had was preparing a statement for him and for me to sign that I would do a videotape interview like my 11 audio tapes, and I would hold it until after his death. He thought that he was not going to live very long in 94. So I was surprised to hear his voice on my voicemail say, "Linda, my wife and I went to the supermarket after you left, and two men were leaning against our car when we came out of the supermarket. And they said, We want to remind you that you have been a loyal American, and we are here to tell you that you are never to talk with Linda Moulton Howe again or to discuss this subject. None of those 11 hours of my audio tapes would have been in the phone calls. So it means that they were listening to our 3 days and 3 nights in the house. And I promised him from that point on that I would never discuss him or the material. And in fact, later on, I received information from someone unknown that he was dead. So I am personally gratified to see that he made a statement today for the citizen hearing, because he is scratching the surface of how complex this is and how military and intel people have been intimidated for not only their whole careers, but their whole lives, to never tell the truth about something so fundamental as we are not alone in this universe, that non-humans have been interacting with this planet for millennia, and you have just heard from one of the first hand. I had placed before you a prepared statement concerning truth embargo and a whole other experience that I had in Kirtland Air Force Base in 1983 that would have been a decade before being able to talk with this man. I hope that you will read it in its entirety. I know I don't have time this morning to go through it, but I can summarize that blocking truth, that we're calling the truth embargo, has been the intent of the American government's official policy of denial since 1947, when the President Truman administration decided that all information about non-human intelligences interacting with this planet should be kept from the public and media, and that includes Congress and the Supreme Court and all machinery of our government except for those designated as having, quote-unquote, a need to know, and the pro words and the numbers that have gone with the few people who have had total access in MJ-12. I encountered truth embargoes repeatedly as I investigated the bloodless, trackless animal mutilations in Colorado and the surrounding region for my TV documentary special, A Strange Harvest, beginning in September of 1979, and I have provided for you a letter from United States Senator Harrison Schmidt, dated March 14, 1979. It is attached to my statement. And it was a letter that Apollo astronaut and then U.S. Senator Harrison Schmidt of New Mexico had sent to constituents announcing a conference in Albuquerque to be held on April 20, 1979, to discuss the ongoing and persistent problem of animal mutilations, and he wanted the Department of Justice and the Federal Bureau of Investigation to investigate. And that 1979 meeting was held, and 5 months later, in September 1979, as Director of Special Projects at the CBS station in Denver, I began what became a 9-month, 18-hour-a-day, 7-days-a-week investigation. And I went to Santa Fe, and I did an interview with Senator Schmidt. And one of the most important things that he told me was, to my question, are you aware of any intelligence committee or any agency that you have communicated with who has told you that we are dealing with extraterrestrial biological entities as perpetrators of worldwide animal mutilations, as law enforcement repeatedly had told me? And I remember the pause and the look on his face when he said no. And I remember that his next words were, but I am not surprised at your question or the implications. And his request as a United States Senator to have the Department of Justice and the Federal Bureau of Investigation formally investigate animal mutilations was blocked. He told me that firsthand. The rest of the pages of the statement that I have submitted to you occurred after I was contracted with Home Box Office on March 21st, 1983, to do an hour special that would follow up A Strange Harvest about the animal mutilations, and they had a working title in the contract that I would produce for them an hour special called UFOs, the ET Factor. And at the time, there was an attorney in New York named Peter Gersten. He was the first attorney to file against the CIA, the NSA, National Reconnaissance Organization, the Defense Intelligence Agency, and other military agencies under the brand new Freedom of Information Act, FOIA, for documents that those agencies had. And what Peter Gersten found was, initially, the Central Intelligence Agency denied that it had any information or documents, but that the National Security Agency had 118. So he would send the Central Intelligence Agency's formal letter to the National Security Agency asking for the documents referenced by the CIA. And the National Security Agency would send him a formal letter referencing the fact that the Central Intelligence Agency had 35 documents shared with the National Security Agency. And eventually, he assembled dozens of documents that came from those agencies, each one pointing about documents that they all said they had. And even though the Supreme Court denied the carrot that they would take on that lawsuit, out of it came many pages of blacked out information that have been held up by Stanton Friedman and others of us over the years, that agencies who are not allowed to speak and who have been responsible for counterintelligence since World War II to convince us that there's nothing to this phenomena.
The witness has about 1 minute remaining.
They are the very agencies who have the information and have been interlinked with Majestic 12 that was appointed by President Harry S. Truman within a very short period of time after the crash retrievals in July of 1947, and that Majestic 12, MJ-12, whatever the letters and numbers are in 2013, the same kind of inner sanctum agency still exists interacting with other inside inner sanctum black agencies. There is a parallel black budget, there's a parallel government, and this is how the truth that this gentleman described and that many people in our government have known since at least 1941, when there was another crash retrieval from Missouri and an instrument called a neutronic propulsion unit was hand-delivered to Oppenheimer for his use in developing and researching what became the atomic bomb. And finally, the truth embargo, so that you would have reference to the two agencies that in the beginning had the most information, the Atomic Energy Commission and the Department of the Navy. All of those documents of all of the truth that he has said that I have tried to report about now for 33 years, they are essentially off limits to any access by Congress or even the president, because they are classified as only under a need to know, and probably Suitland, Maryland archive has them.
And the witness's time. Thank you.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Linda Moulton Howe.
Now the panel will hear from Richard Dalton. You have 10 minutes.
Greetings, honored members of the committee. I'm very pleased about the interview that everyone was just shown and grateful that Linda Moulton Howe was able to elaborate on that. I'm happy to discuss this also if the committee members have questions, but I have a different angle of approach this time. The truth embargo, as I see it, as I understand it, let's call it a big picture analysis. I would start by saying one of the striking things about UFOs is simply the discrepancy between the quantity of astonishing sightings we have on the one hand and the lack of responsible treatment of this by our major media, also our academic and our scientific institutions, and indeed our political system. This is a shame because there's very good research that's being done every day. Many of those researchers have been here this week. Others are out there too, such as the National Aviation Reporting Center on Anomalous Phenomena, NARCAP, which was referenced in the previous panel by Jim Courant. They collect and analyze encounters that the aviation industry has had with unknown objects. There are thousands of such cases. Another group is Project 1947, which is documented UFO phenomena during the early Cold War years. There are outstanding web search websites, such as ufoevidence.org. There are also many excellent research groups in Europe and elsewhere in the world. None of them get any love from America's dum-dum media, which prefers to lump the whole subject into a big tinfoil hat and instead write about the latest escapades of Kim Kardashian. But this is a symptom. It's a symptom of a deeper problem. And to understand why there is a truth embargo, we need to come to terms with the fact that America's major media groups lost their independence a long time ago. We all know about media consolidation. We all know about the intimate relationships that have existed for years between the elite members in the corporate media empire and the political leadership, and particularly with the military and intelligence community. Last year, one example only, it was learned that the Pentagon spends some $4 billion a year to sway public opinion. Now, aside from asking just why Americans ought to be paying their own government to brainwash them, I mean, talk about getting shafted both ways, this is just one facet of many that highlight a revolving door through which passes the military-industrial complex, the media, the academic community, and more. National security money, which is our nation's greatest and most egregious waste of all, has infiltrated everything, and that certainly means the once-upon-a-time integrity of our journalists and media corporations. This is repugnant to any freedom-loving people. But those individuals benefiting from this system are not freedom-loving, unless they mean their own freedom. The bottom line is that because UFOs are a definite matter of national security, those national security decision-makers have made it certain that the subject remains out of sight as much as possible. Is this not obvious by now? Now, why would they do this? Well, many reasons. Let's touch on the matter of oil, because even a child can understand that these objects don't need oil to go from point A to point B. Whatever powers flying saucers, it's something different, something better. So if the president were to announce the reality of these things, how long do you think it would take before scientists openly begin to study the nature of the propulsion and power system of UFOs? This would immediately challenge oil, not simply as the world's leading source of power, but it would severely threaten the entire global financial system, which is based upon oil. And probably 90% of the value of any product you can think of is determined by the energy that went into making and transporting it, and in most cases that means oil, to say nothing of the millions of jobs that rely on the petroleum industry. We're talking one big overhaul of everything that matters in the global economy. Can we think for an instant that those individuals in the know haven't thought about this, especially if there is that holy grail involved, some form of free energy? What if this new form of energy can't be easily monetized? What if? Could the global financial structure afford free energy? A perverse question, to be sure, but one that has to be important to those individuals at the top of the human power structure. And of course, there is the political nightmare. Any announcement of this reality would come at the cost of worldwide public anger. No one wants to learn that they've been lied to for an entire human lifetime. They would want to know just how this secret was kept. That's very, very big key right there. That would lead inevitably to questions about why Congress was kept out of the loop, why our major institutions missed the boat, and just who has been managing the secret. And that would lead, obviously, to a wholesale investigation of black budget America, shining sunlight into a very dark place. And what might we find? Well, consider. Just consider that Roswell was indeed what the researchers here 2 days ago discussed so eloquently and cogently, that it was the retrieval of alien technology and perhaps bodies. In fact, there are a number of well-researched UFO crash events, so suppose for a moment that it happened. That would mean that the cover-up involves much more than mere knowledge of other beings here on planet Earth. It would mean there is possession of such advanced technology as to be nearly incomprehensible, at least at first. Hard to consider, and yet an inevitable conclusion. So what happens when teams of brilliant scientists with total secrecy and nearly limitless black budget funds are able to study recovered alien technology for many years and even decades? Could it not be that, given enough time and effort, even if they couldn't replicate what they found, they might have learned a few things? Some such claims have been made, and it's reasonable to suppose that breakthroughs would have been made. Breakthroughs such as solid-state electronics, fiber optics, high tensile fibers, lasers, and an array of other money-making opportunities for the defense and other industries. None of this has been proven, but it is also true that the private research undertaken in classified environments is not easy for outside researchers to observe. And in fact, it would be very easy to hide the Roswell connection in the historical treatment of these and other technologies. Another relevant consideration of such breakthroughs is that they would reduce to zero any incentive to reveal the secret to the public. Why give up the goose that lays golden eggs? But now matters become even more interesting, because what if some of the breakthroughs were even more significant? What if they included secrets to what is known as field propulsion or electrogravitics? What if they led to a new source of energy, something that could replace petroleum? To those managing these special access programs, they could never allow such breakthroughs to see the light of day. Of course, those scientists doing the research would need to continue and learn everything they could about electrogravitics, anti-gravity, new sources of energy, and any related topics. Consider also what happens when such breakthroughs become classified. We know it happens all too frequently that public science has become hostage to national security. What we're looking at is a situation in which the classified black budget world, at least part of it, has gone so far ahead of the rest of us, we may with justice almost look upon them as a separate society, something I've sometimes called a breakaway civilization. How far ahead might some of that classified world be? Those of us on the outside trying to peek in can only make educated guesses or investigate occasional leaks. My own conclusion, at least for now, is that they are very far ahead indeed, with the ability even to enter and leave Earth orbit with much greater ease than people suspect, perhaps a clandestine space fleet, most likely a significant built infrastructure, a large portion of which is deep underground, and even, why not, possible encounters with non-human intelligences? Why would that be so impossible? To what extent would such a group even answer to the President of the United States? Do they rather answer to private, international, financial powers, which basically is how the whole world already operates? I had a long conversation once with a retired senior intelligence official. He had given briefings to...
I hate to interrupt. The witness has about 1 minute.
I have 1 minute left. Thank you. This gentleman had given briefings to President Reagan. This man knows a very great deal about UFOs and told me that he had spoken to 18 former presidents, CIA directors, and DOD secretaries about UFOs after their retirement. Their attitudes fell into three categories. One group, roughly three or four of them, said essentially, "What's wrong with you? Why waste your time with that nonsense?" Another equally small group made it clear that they had been briefed on the matter and knew that it was serious. But the largest group, at least half of all of the individuals who had been at the pinnacle of power, had said, "You know about UFOs? I would love to know about that, but got nowhere. Can you share what you know?" In other words, our top political leadership, with a few exceptions, is locked out of this subject because they come and go. But the program managers are lifers. They seem to answer to someone else. Recall the words of the late Senator Daniel Inouye from 1987, "There exists a shadowy government with its own Air Force, its own Navy, its own fundraising mechanism, and the ability to pursue its own ideas of national interest, free from all checks and balances and free from the law itself." He was on to something.
Thank you.
Amazing stuff, everybody. You're watching Disclosure roll out right in front of your eyes. That testimony can never be taken back. It was said in front of a congressional panel. This is deeply serious. And this is the real thing. I'm going to end it here today, everybody, but please come back tomorrow. We have much more to share together. Have a wonderful day. Namaste.